hopelessly hoping her harlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word, gasping at glimpses of gentle true spirit. He runs, wishing he could fly, I only to trip at the sound of goodbye.
This is David Bruckner, director of The Ritual, and you are listening to the Grindhouse Society.
House Messiah, sorry it's been a few weeks since we've gotten to reach out and touch somebody, but we missed you, and we're back, and today we are going to talk about a couple movies that we really love. But before we do, we have a couple pieces of business. First, let me introduce my co-host, Blaine. How's it going?
What's going on, man? Just glad to be back. It's been too long. I've been really disappointed with not doing more episodes lately, because my existence kind of hangs on this. It's how I define myself, sadly enough.
Well, you know, it is what it is. I define myself by, well, other things most of the time. But what,
like,
I do
what, like,
really
family?
Enjoy.
Look at me. Yeah, I got a family.
But unfortunately, a couple of our guests' schedules and our schedules got all screwed up this month. It was my fault. I had to postpone an episode, and then other folks had to postpone an episode, but we have a few stuff lined up, and we're still working those things out. But we're here, just the two of us today, to talk about a couple movies by one Alex Garland, and we'll get into that briefly. But I want to first start by saying two things. One is thank you to all of you who've been listening for the last year. This is our one-year anniversary episode, which means we got a little contest going on. It also means we made it through our first year, so don't we get some kind of, like, what's the gift for the one-year anniversary? Paper? Isn't it, like, paper?
Oh, man, I don't know anything about that. I barely made it a few years into anniversaries, and
oh, man, I'm at, like, 14, man. I'm an old fart in my marriage, so.
Oh, shit. Have I ever told you my worst anniversary story to know what kind of husband I was?
No, but I feel like there might be a story coming on right now.
Yeah, I enjoy playing cards, and during our two-year anniversary, we were beginning to go out for dinner, and I got a text message that the former winner of the World Series of Poker, Chris Moneymaker, was at my game, where I told my ex-wife, now ex-wife, current wife at the time, hey, let's skip dinner and go watch me play cards. Another reason I am no longer married.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that went out real well. I'm sure that went over like a ton of bricks.
Oh, it went over real well until I got the paperwork.
Oh, man. So with that, our hopefully we last a little bit longer than Blaine's marriage did. However,
most things do.
And you guys, and those of you who are listeners know that Blaine and his ex-wife are actually really good friends at this point, so it's fun to joke because life is actually going pretty well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, this is not sad sack shit. If you guys didn't know, I did have a show for a while, even with her new husband, that unfortunately he's just too busy to hang out with me, but you know, that's how things go.
So our for our first anniversary, we have a giveaway, which is going to be part of the next segment. But I want to, before I get there, I really want to thank our sponsor for our whole first year, pretty much. After, you know, a couple episodes in, they kind of jumped in and started, you know, sponsoring us. And I want to thank Vinegar Syndrome. If you're listening to this on the day it comes out, there's probably at least a few hours left of the halfway to Black Friday sale that they do every Memorial Day. Most of their titles are like half off. They have like a big deal on a package for the rest of the year. I think you can get all the Blu-rays for the rest of the year for like $375, which for as many as they have set to release, that's a really good deal. So check those things out over at vinegarsyndrome.com. And thanks to those folks. And this episode is also sponsored by a little movie called Annihilation. You ever heard of that one, Blaine?
Yeah, man. If I remember correctly, that thing came out in theaters.
yeah, it came out in theaters. At least here in America, it did. They decided to release via Netflix everywhere else in the world. But here in America, it did pretty well and actually got really great reviews. And we have a copy on Blu-ray to give away to one of you lucky listeners. All you got to do is one thing, one little thing, and that is share your favorite episode from our first year. It doesn't matter what episode it is. Share it on a social media platform and tag us. That's all you got to do. Once we get that tag, you'll be entered into our drawing, and we will pick a. I'm trying to think what I was about to say. I just stumbled across my words. We're gonna pick somebody.
Yeah,
to win a DVD Blu-ray.
Yeah, we're just gonna draw a name, dude.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why. Like, I all of a sudden I had a brain fart. But as everybody here knows, I probably won't edit that out because I'm a bad editor. But on the other hand, I think we have good content, and I hope you like our podcast. So any episode from this first year, just share that with your friends, tag us, and do that within the next week. And by the time our next episode comes, we will announce the winner, and we'll send that Blu-ray out to you. And we really appreciate all the support we've gotten. And on that note, we'll have some announcements. We've been teasing about our Patreon, but by next episode, we're going to have some big announcements about that. And some more giveaways, which is awesome. So I really appreciate Annihilation for sponsoring this episode as well. And with that, we're going to talk about the director of Annihilation and his first movie as well, Ex Machina. Blaine, tell us a little bit about Alex Garland and your experience with this fine gentleman.
Alex Garland was someone that really, before I knew the name, my brother actually kind of put me on. He was a big fan of his novels, we went and saw The Beach just like everybody else at the time, which I know is kind of gets a weird response these days because there's some shit in that movie that really didn't age very well. But at the time, I was super high on Danny Boyle, still a director that I enjoy. But that movie came out, really resonated with my little brother Brandon. And he started reading through his books and ended up giving me a copy of Tesseract and absolutely blew my mind. Saw the shitty movie that was made from it with, I think, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. But as he's gone, I mean, he's really been a solid writing partner to Danny Boyle. They put out, of course, 28 Days Later, The Beach, Sunshine, which all those are... In my opinion, like, they're above average movies. I mean, Sunshine, I could go on and on about how I think it falls apart in the third act, but that's shit no one cares about right now. But I mean, over the past few years as a director, he's been really kind of rocking my world because, like, I'm not a huge sci-fi guy, but I love good sci-fi, especially when it kind of has that horror tinge to it that Alex Garland can't seem to get away from. So, but yeah, he's a fantastic writer. Really, I think one of the more interesting directors currently out there, and pretty prolific. I mean, because Ex Machina came out in 2015, which was a big special effects film, and so, I mean, just 3 years later we got Annihilation. So I'm looking forward to a couple years from now to see what that dude's got up next. What about you, man?
So, yeah, no, Blaine, I agree with everything that you just said. As far as my introduction to him, I was not necessarily as into his books. I've only read The Beach, but I do really enjoy The Beach. I've really enjoyed everything that I've read or seen or heard related to Mr. Garland here. And I just think he's a really talented dude, and I can't shake the fact that I think his 1-2 punch with Ex Machina and Annihilation is one of the best as far as genre film directors go that I can even think of. It really is a pretty remarkable start to a directing career.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I especially on that level, because I think for a lot of directors, especially when they're in the Hollywood studio system, there is that sophomore slump. A lot of times people, it's really hard to kind of, it's kind of like what they say when you're making your first album as a musician. That's your life's work you're putting into this first thing. Now try to do it again. And I think that Alex Garland, I mean, I think that, you know, luckily he had already been working in film, but really, and we'll get to this, but I think he outdoes himself in the second movie. Having watched both of these movies in the past 24 hours as rewatches.
That's a tough thing to say. The concepts in both are phenomenal. The actual directing job, I think you might be right about. I think he got even better. But there's something about that first film about Ex Machina, which we're going to ride right into right now, that really, I don't know, it really hits me. So the IMDb description of Ex Machina, plot summary.
Don't cheat.
I'm cheating. But a young programmer is selected to participate in a groundbreaking experiment in synthetic intelligence by evaluating the human qualities of a breathtaking humanoid AI.
Over the next few days, you're going to be the human component in the Turing test.
One day the AIs are going to look back on us the same way we look at fossils.
Hello.
How do you feel about her?
Oh, man, she's amazing.
You're impressed?
Yes.
Do you want to be my friend?
Of course. Now the question is, how does she feel about you?
Do you think about me when we aren't together?
Did you give her sexuality as a diversion tactic?
This is your insecurity talking. This is not your intellect.
Fine.
Did you know that I was brought here to test you?
Does Ava actually like you? Or is she pretending to like you?
Nathan, he isn't your friend. You're wrong.
Wrong about what?
Everything. Do you want to be with me?
Can we talk about the lies you've been spinning me?
What lies?
What lies?
You have to help me.
You have to help me.
What will happen to me if I fail your test?
Can I get my version?
Yeah. So go ahead, Blaine. Give your not cheating version.
Two nerds sit in a house trying not to kiss while fantasizing about finally having sex with a computer.
I mean, I don't know that I disagree, but I don't think I would have put it so succinctly.
I'm sorry.
But I can tell. One thing I didn't realize about this film until I was looking it up after rewatching it is it was distributed by A24, and man, this must have been like the beginning of that huge run of amazing A24 films, because in the last 2 years since this time, man, they have put out some amazing stuff. But I didn't even realize this was one of their, you know, one of their releases. But it's a fantastic movie. As Blaine put it before, it's a dark, like, horror-tinged sci-fi film. I think it's more than horror-tinged. The ending of this movie makes it straight-up horror, as far as I'm concerned. It is just so... The ending is so dark and bleak. And it just kind of is a thud to the chest. But the actual film as a whole, I mean... It's very much that Uncanny Valley kind of thing, which of course it's AI, so of course it's uncanny. They're trying to put this AI to the test as to whether or not it can be convince people that it's real. That's essentially the whole premise of this movie, right?
Oh yeah, they're running the test in kind of a late stage testing for this like highly developed self-aware AI that's being tested. And I mean, and I'm with you. I said horror tinged because I think what he does well in these movies, and especially in Ex Machina, he kind of goes in and out of the horror. It's he kind of doesn't go so far into it that it kind of descends into like, you know, basically like a Terminator ripoff or something that can, you know, get corny. It's very, very serious. It's very grounded in a real world kind of way. And and in running these tests, more gets kind of exposed of how our main character was picked, why Poe Dameron is doing this.
Poe Dameron.
Yeah, which is so much fun to see those two guys working together between Donald Gleason and Oscar Isaac, not in Star Wars, because I love them in Star Wars, don't get me wrong, both of them, but it's really fun. But yeah, because it's funny how at this time they were, well regarded actors, but look at the three main characters, three out of four of the only people in the film, how big their careers have gone on with Donald Gleason and Oscar Isaac, who are both well-defined, but then you also have Vikander. I can't remember her name, but she's Laura Croft now.
Alicia Vikander, yeah. She's certainly blowing up. I mean, obviously, as far as, in the genre world, she more recently did the, the reboot of Tomb Raider, but she's also been in... a bunch of stuff the Jason Bourne movie Man from U.N.C.L.E. that came out a little bit later than this one in 2015, and I think she's done a bunch of high end artsy movies that I don't know very well as well.
Yeah, because I know her from her Oscar nod in the Danish Girl.
Oh yeah, that would be one of the ones I'm referring to when I say movies I've not seen.
I don't think we'll be covering that either.
No, the Danish girl, she likes to eat Danishes?
It's about
a dad joke. I should probably just go. Yeah. I'll let you take over the rest of the episode after that one. So there's this thing called the Turing test that they do first, right? Which is that the Turing test is can people tell whether or not they're talking to a human or an AI? And obviously, they do that. Oscar Isaac's Poe Dameron, as you called him, character kind of does that before the Donald Gleason gets there, and now they're trying to really break down, how real her thinking is, how real everything is, and just test. And like you said, each test kind of breaks down further and further, you find out more about the history of what's going on with the tests and, a little bit more about Nathan, the main character, Poe's motivations and his history, and a lot of stuff just comes out, and it's really, really interesting how it all breaks down. The Caleb, which is Donald Gleason's character, eventually finds out that they're going to upgrade, and that's going to wipe out the whole personality and memory that the AI Ava has developed, and that essentially becomes a big catalyst in what's going to happen next, because he's basically it seems like he's falling in love with her. Would you agree?
I think, because we kind of find out, and this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler thing, just because we do have to get into the meat of the film.
So I don't want to go all the way to the ending, because I think that's such a gut punch that I think people should watch it. But we can definitely spoil a little just to make sure that we kind of get at the themes here.
Right, because with what's going on, as you find out, she is specifically designed for him to fall in love with. It is literally his own personal manic pixie dream girl. That they've taken from basically doing what we just found out Facebook was actually doing, which was stealing all your information and constructing an AI based on it. I think that is, at the time it was whoa, that's mind blowing. Now it's oh no, that's why I get ads for, stuff that I specifically want. So I think that is such a great early twist, because there's so many more things that get exposed as you go. And and he is, I do believe that he is legitimately developing, a form of love. And I like how the film kind of leaves it in this strange thing where it's somewhere between, oh, how sweet, like a puppy, and also I want to bang this robot. Just because it is playing into his kind of his base instincts as far as sexuality goes, as well as being this thing that's I don't know, it's almost like that idea of, having a person that's never known anyone else, and you are their world. So I think it's so smart in how it develops those early scenes and how uncomfortable it is, because I think a lot of the tenseness of this film comes from watching two strangers, one that knows that this is just a test of a product. Essentially, it's like playing with an iPad. And the other one is seemingly just developing their entire personality and their skills and interacting with humans. So I think that is such a cool idea that gets fleshed out pretty well.
Definitely. I mean, and I think that, you know, obviously there are a lot of overtones here of the idea of playing God. I think that's something that we're definitely going to figure. I even think to some extent that falls into what we're going to talk about with Annihilation too. But this movie is definitely, I mean, in so many senses, this is a modern sci-fi take on, you know, the Frankenstein story. You know what I mean? This is very much the creation of life and manipulating that life and what can go wrong when you do. So, you know, there's also a very strong, I would say, the writing of this has a very strong Isaac Asimov influence. I don't know how much Isaac Asimov you've read, but, you know, I definitely think there's a lot of that, you know, in as much as, you know, just the idea of creating these artificial beings and not always putting the proper checks and balances in place.
right, and I think it's that idea of like of an irresponsible God, trying to reach these points, but not but just tweaking enough. I'm trying to think of what the word would be, enough manipulations to make something incredibly dangerous.
Well, yeah, or like just you said irresponsible. There's a notion of like there's always seems to be a notion of knowing, like in the back of people's heads, knowing when they're going a little too far but not caring. Like almost knowing where the limit should be but not following that limit, even though somewhere in the back of your head you do know. You know, like I feel like that's definitely the case here too, in a large extent. You know, like I definitely think that Oscar Isaac's character, somewhere in the way, you know, things are being done, he knows when he's going too far and doesn't really give a fuck.
Oh yeah, he knows he's already gone too far. By the time we've shown up, he physically looks depleted. He's drinking constantly. He's putting on this sort of like very bro, ultra masculine sort of show for this. What he thinks is kind of this, you know, this kind of this beta male he's brought into his world, but he's clearly knows that it's done by the time he shows up, and you can tell in the interactions, especially after you've seen it a couple times and you're watching that first 20 minutes, you're like, holy shit, he kind of already knows how this movie's going to end.
He does kind of hint to the fact there are definitely rewatching it. There are definitely allusions that he's not necessarily thinking things are going to end well.
Isn't that kind of the point when you have a movie like this, which is basically, like you mentioned, it's just a postmodernist take on Prometheus, right? So wouldn't a postmodern Prometheus know what he's doing?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, and obviously I brought up Frankenstein, which is essentially just another. That was the gothic romance take on Prometheus. So I mean, they're all kind of, you know, part of the same story that's told over and over, and so important to be told because you look at real life and we're doing this stuff. You know, in a very real sense, with this movie, we're doing AI a lot lately, and every time you hear about these scientific breakthroughs, I can't help but wonder, like, is this a good breakthrough or not?
But you know what always makes me feel good about it is when I go on YouTube and watch these you know, billion-dollar robots not be able to conquer normal day-to-day shit and still slip on like banana peels and stuff. that is one of my favorite things.
Like, but like, how many times do I mean, mind you, it's only happened a few times, but still, a few times is too many. Where, you know, these self-driving cars cause freaking deadly accidents, you know, or things like that. You know, there's no accounting for, you know, just the anomalies and the things about, you know, real life that make humans able to navigate it better than other people. Well, you know, I mean, I just think, or there is only one kind of person. Other things better than other living things. Maybe that's the better way to put it. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's it definitely just I feel like this is another, you know, it's a cautionary tale, obviously. And I think it gets at the root of it a lot. And I mean, there's some, you know, beyond just the themes and the whatever, this film is just, there's a lot of fun moments, you know, what's more fun than the dance scene?
Oh, yeah.
Like, the dance scene in this movie is just so brilliant and fun.
Yeah, because above everything, all the, like, really, you know, intense tones and all this stuff that I walk away with the movie from, the thing that always comes to mind is that dance scene, because it is just, it's so stark. And I don't know, I think it just shows the kind of that talent behind the camera that's going, because he cuts to it in such a way that is uncomfortable. It's disturbing, and then so much fun, and then it goes straight back to what it was doing before. And that dancing serves such a great purpose.
And, right, it does.
And I don't want to jump out of the dance scene, so I'm gonna hold off. What I was gonna say next, but yeah, I mean, how much do you love that?
Oh, that's it. I mean, sure. I love it. Like, I see the purpose it serves and all that stuff too. But mostly, I love it because it's fun. It's just a fun scene, and it's a fun scene that, it, you know, it's totally different than a lot of the darker things in the film, but at the same time fits completely because, like you're saying, it serves its purpose. It's it breaks up things. It's also very human. Like, we're stressed and we're going through all this stuff, and sometimes we just need to fucking cut loose.
Right. But don't forget, right before it, he's trying to talk to the slave robot, and he's like, "Don't fucking talk to her. Why don't you dance with her?" It's so uncomfortable. It takes on those tones. Then by the end, you're like, you kind of forget. That you're like, oh yeah, right. This is just fun watching, watching Oscar Isaac dance, and oh god, Oscar Isaac is so good in this movie.
Well, there's like, you know, we brought up, there's really only three primary actors, and they're all phenomenal.
Right.
Like, they all are so fantastic in this movie. Like, that's what makes this movie. It's, you know, it's well written. I mean, like, you can tell, like, don't get me wrong, it looks good, it's got a budget. But you probably could have done this movie with less effects and less budget and been almost as successful, because it's the acting. As long as you have those actors in that script, you're good. You know what I mean?
I agree with that to a point, but I did want to mention that I think that the amazing visual effects in this movie bring it to another level, though. Having this robot that looks so much like the robots we're seeing develop now, in the way it moves, and like, just like you said, it plays on that uncanny valley side so well that I do think that the visual effects and that budget really was necessary to this up, you know, to elevate it. I think it would have been a great small, you know, like, single location film, you know, made for, you know, around, you know, a couple hundred grand, you know, whatever. But what elevates it and makes it something that's probably going to, you know, stand the test of time, I think adding those visual effects and putting so much care into the robots is what may last forever.
And I think that'll be a good segue into the next film, because obviously Annihilation, is the effects are a huge part of that film. Maybe the one of the biggest parts of that film. But that said, one thing I wanted to hit on before I moved from Ex Machina is, I couldn't help but continually think of, you know, the literary and, you know, often used in film, you know, device term Deus Ex Machina, you know, with the title. And it's funny because that, you know, for people who aren't familiar, basically means that, like, it's like a plot element where, like, things so effortlessly come together, like, it seems like it's divine. It's like divine intervention. And what's funny about this film, to me, when I think about that in the title, is that it almost feels like there's divine intervention on the other side, like God smiting them the way it ends, as right. opposed to God making things all work. It's kind of reverse deus ex machina. And that always intrigued me because, you know, I mean, quite literally, deus ex machina means God in the machine or God from the machine. And that's an interesting concept to think of just those words in the literal sense as well when you think about this movie. You know, because there's so much about God versus machine, God creating machine, machine maybe becoming God. In a completely Terminator Skynet sense. So, you know, I bring that up just to say, and that doesn't give away the title, the film's ending really, because when you watch it, it's just the way it ends. Well, even if you know what's going to happen, the way it ends is so impactful.
Right. Yeah. Because with that ending, you know, not going into detail. Once again, I feel like the film is letting you know what that ending's going to be. And you know it's coming. So when it happens, it's even more of a gut punch where you're like, oh, shit, it's really going to happen as the way that I imagined it would. And I think that is a smart way to kind of cut through different expectations by saying, no, this is the end. This is the ending you know has to happen.
Right. In the back of your head, you're going, they're not going to quite go there, are they? They're not going to. Oh, yeah, they are. And I mean, I agree with you in that regard. And but yeah, I think what you were saying about the effects is a great segue into Annihilation, because I think that movie is so much about the visual.
Can you describe its form?
No.
Was it carbon based? Did it communicate with you?
It reacted to me.
You really have no idea what it was.
Did your husband contact you at any point while he was away?
No.
It was his decision to go in.
Why did my husband volunteer for a suicide mission? You have to tell me where he was, what he was doing. I need to know what's inside. I could save him.
So with that, why don't you give us a little plot of Annihilation, whether you want to cheat like me on IMDb or you want to give me another one of your cool, you know, homemade ones, which are significantly more entertaining.
Well, I wish I had a better homemade one for this. I mean, basically, a biologist who used to be a soldier ends up kind of signing on to this suicide mission to go check out this extraterrestrial sphere type thingy to bobber that's showed up on the U.S. coast, and kind of wants to find out what happened to her husband, as well as dealing with, you know, what's happened in the past and kind of looking to the future. And I don't know, a lot happens. Is that the dumb worst description ever?
That should be the whole thing. A lot of stuff happens.
A lot happens, and there's ladies honestly, doing it.
You explained it a lot better than the IMDb breakdown, which is a one sentence. A biologist signs up for a dangerous secret expedition into a mysterious zone where the laws of nature don't apply.
Hey, combine the really, two, that, and you've got an actual right? description.
Right, and that's what it is. I mean, you know, the main character, her name's Lena in the film. I don't know if you've read the book. My wife has, and we've talked about it. I haven't gotten a chance to yet, but you know, the book, the characters are all just known by their profession, so Lena's just called the biologist in the book.
That makes sense.
But, yeah, and, like, so there's the biologist, there's the psychiatrist, you know, like this, so it's, but basically, Lena's husband, Kane, the great Poe Dameron again, Yeah, and obviously Alex Garland likes working with that gentleman there, and I don't blame him. He's a fine actor. But you get to see a little bit of their relationship, and you find out that he went away on this mission, and he's been gone for a year, or missing for a year at this point. They don't know, you know. And all of a sudden, he shows back up one night while she is listening to their favorite song and painting the bedroom, and kind of almost like she's trying to kind of move on a little or something, and he shows up. Except there's something wrong with him, and they have to rush him to the hospital. On the way to the hospital, they get the feds show up and come grab them both and bring them to a secret hospital, a secret place, a secret fortress, the place called the Southern Reach. And from there, she wants to know what's wrong with her husband. She wants to know what's going on. So she signs up to do this mission, which seems like essentially a suicide mission. No one's ever come back. Except for him, but he's all types of fucked up a year later. So he's actually the first person who ever even returned, period. So so that's the setup for this film. I think one of the big important things they talk about in that little description, that one sentence IMDb, is that the laws of nature don't apply in this zone, they refer to as the shimmer. All types of weird shit goes on. So they go on this mission. Then they kind of come to 3 days after they walk into the shimmer, realizing they don't remember what the hell happened the first 3 days. They just kind of wake up at camp. And then they start to move on and start to encounter weird animals, weird vegetation. Everything is mutated. And one of the cool things about all the mutated stuff is it's all freaking gorgeous. Would you agree with that?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no. It's gorgeous. It's ridiculous at times, and once again, this is a very dour film, kind of like Ex Machina, but it's got these fantastic creatures and these settings that really, I mean, you kind of forget because this takes place kind of along the coastline of like North Carolina, right?
Yeah, I think it's Carolina.
Well, North or South Carolina, but yeah, it's so amazing the way things look. The way that the way things keep shifting and changing, and pretty grotesque too. I mean, it's
right.
Yes, and I love when you're, because you don't mind if I just kind of hop into the film, right?
Oh, please hop in. Please.
Yeah, what I love is when you're giving that description of kind of how things are leading up to this. It happens incredibly fast, and
right, it does.
And it almost has this like intentionally kind of corny vibe to where, you know, she's painting the room, she's listening to Helplessly Hoping by Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
And yeah, I didn't know the name of the song, but I knew it was like this like lovey-dovey
yeah
bullshit.
But I mean, it's literally called Helplessly Hoping, like, and
wow,
you know, he shows up and but then it cuts quick. They're there, they're going on this trip, they introduce everyone just enough, and we're in the shimmer and we're going, which is another thing that I loved about his last film as well, Ex Machina. There's not a whole lot of dicking around. Like, we're here to see annihilation. We're not here to see everything else. You can tell that story, and I think this is where he really matures as a visual filmmaker, is being able to like seamlessly show you everything that happened before and kind of blend the film along with with the theme that everything is happening at once and everything is kind of congealing in this chaos that works so well, though, in the way that he kind of helms the whole feature. So, I mean, I love that. I mean, let's just hop into the monsters, because this is my favorite part of this whole fucking movie.
Oh, man. So, you know, I guess, like, the first one you encounter is probably the least bizarre and least mutated in a lot of ways. It just looks like a huge-ass crocodile.
Crocodile, then, shark.
Well, it looks like a huge-ass crocodile with kind of sharkish coloring. Then when they open its fucking mouth, they realize it has shark teeth. And also that it's like it's got these weird mutated layers of teeth like a fish, you know, where it's got, you know, not just one, you know, set of teeth, but like 10 of them.
Right.
And it's like it's insane. It's enormous. And yeah, so that's like the first thing, and you already know at that point things are a little off. Even before they encounter that, you know, the vegetation is there's one plant growing 15 different flowers off the same plant. Completely different flowers. Like, there's all different shit that's going on. And so, you know, we've got the big crocodile. Then, there's a whole bunch of little things that come out and crazy monsters, but the thing that one that gets me the most is there's basically this big bear thing that has its skull on the outside, essentially.
Yeah.
It's the fucking creepiest fucking thing in the world. And whenever it kills somebody, that person's, like, soul becomes part of it.
It screams and growls and basically communicates through the screams of its victims. So you have a man, like a man skull faced giant bear that that growls and screams with its victim. I don't know. I love it so much because this is the
speaking of Uncanny Valley too. Like, I mean, it's not. I know it's not like almost human, but it's almost bear. You know what I mean? And like even like the screams. It's got these human screams like that are part of it, but they're not quite human the way they come out. They come out like very like a combination of a growl and a human scream. It's the weirdest fucking sound. It's so creepy.
Oh yeah, and did, have you ever read how they basically designed it?
No.
They ended up basically doing like 3D animation and just kind of putting everything in there, including like the facial recognition and the physiology of a human inside of a, you know, of the bear, and creating like this like just super killing machine. And what's funny is this is also the same team that made Paddington.
Interesting. I mean, and that's not actually as surprising, you know, because Paddington's basically a bear human hybrid, so that kind of makes sense.
Right, that makes sense. But one is a murderous killing machine.
One's fluffy,
machine.
Adorable, and one is yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other one's. Let's not go too far with this whole adorable thing. Kind of annoying and a glutton. Like,
I'm not a fan of the Paddington stuff anyway. So yeah. I grew up a Paddington cartoon fan as a kid, but the movies don't do anything for me.
Nothing. I wish adults would stop pretending that the movies are made for them. But that goes besides the point.
Next episode, we'll be covering Paddington 1 and 2. No, we won't. But anyway.
Yeah. But another thing that I wanted to hold on to, so we talked about Annihilation, to also kind of reference his other film as well, is what I love about these movies and why I think that they're films that we should be talking about on a show like ours that mainly focuses on, B-movies and horror and exploitation, is that while these films are incredibly smart, well-crafted, relatively expensive sci-fi dramas, they're also like this elevated form of B-movie, where in Ex Machina, you kind of have this kind of this slasher Terminator vibe. In this film, you have this kind of 50s and 60s era sci-fi monster movie that I think just kind of, it's really a film that just, it takes those premises that are goofy and fun, adds a huge budget and an apt explanation to kind of to make this elevated monster movie, because as you go further and further into this film, the more and more it becomes this B movie. And I saw this movie originally with my mother in theaters. And I always kind of use her as kind of a bounce off because, you know, she has a lot less appreciation sometimes for those kind of movies. And to be honest, she loved the movie until we finally kind of get to it. And it kind of felt that once it starts entering this B-movie, monster movie flick kind of thing, that it did lose her. And so I was kind of curious, I mean, if... Well, what kind of, with the way this film shifts, what were kind of your feelings about that?
I mean, my wife and I both have a general appreciation for a lot of that kind of sci-fi stuff, and so I think that the B movie sci-fi aspect, monster movie kind of thing, totally vibe with us. I think you're right in a lot of ways. I also think, since you referenced, Ex Machina, you know, that we talked about, like, the robotics, and I mentioned Isaac Asimov and stuff. even though it's not robots per se or AI in that same type of AI or anything, I always feel like the climax of this film, which I'm not going to ruin, has a lot of elements of that, that those same influences as well.
Yes. Kind of the same and, movie.
Yeah. And ultimately, at the end, we're almost brought to a similar feeling, a similar message at the end. And maybe we're not playing God as much in this particular film, although we definitely are a little bit. There's also an element of be careful what you wish for and who's in charge and et cetera at the end. But there's definitely a lot of the same maybe call it cinematic language or like influence from those same like old school sci-fi guys, you know, is definitely in here. It's one of the things I really like. So it's interesting because it's got a lot of that B movie feel, but you know what else it also has is a whole lot of really nerdy sciencey stuff.
Yes.
This movie is very nerdy sciencey stuff. And so I've not read Jeff Vandermeer's book, but my wife said the book is even more nerdy sciencey to a large extent. So I think I'm kind of excited to sit down and read it because that excites me. Although the one disappointing factor is that he wrote a trilogy. That's all, you know, pretty solid, but it's not it's probably not going to all be translated on screen. This is probably a one and done movie because of the way it ends and because of the fact that and if they do continue it, it will have to continue in a completely different way than the books do because of the ending. So when Alex Garland wrote this, it was only one book, he actually bought the manuscript before it was published from Jeff Vandermeer.
Oh, geez.
Obviously, you know, he didn't know that it was going to be more to it, but he said like he wouldn't mind loving to see somebody continue with that and work with Jeff Vandermeer on, you know, adapting scripts to make it work. But he spent 3 or 4 years in this world putting it together, and he's ready to move to his next thing. So we're not going to see Garland do a sequel. Whether or not there is a sequel, it won't be Garland.
Can I make a prediction?
Yeah.
Netflix owns this film. I could see a Garland-produced series.
I think a Garland-produced television series based on how could they, you know, they'll have to figure out how to adapt the ideas in the book to where the movie ended.
Or before, you know, the movie started.
That's true.
There's a lot of things you could do, because that thing... You could tell a lot of stories around it and inside that.
Or, I wouldn't be surprised if just the success of it would cause Jeff Vandermeer and Alex Garland together to work on something different for Netflix.
That's what I hope, because in all honesty, I know we're playing around with just kind of cynically predicting the very, very predictable landscape of movies and TV right now. But I don't think I mentioned this. So far, this is my favorite movie of 2018, and I don't want to read the book. I don't want a TV series. I don't want a sequel. I love the way this exists, and I'm sure if I read the book, it's a great book. But I don't know. I kind of have this thing where if I find a movie that I love, I don't want anything else to really touch it, which I know is, you know, it can be a limiting thing.
You sound like you're ruining my childhood.
No, I'm not one of those people. if given the option, I'd say, make something new. Because I do think that, you know, that writer is playing into ideas and themes that work really well with
Alex Garland and Jeff Vandermeer have a lot of overlapping ideas that could be fleshed out really well working together, I think. I mean, Alex Garland wrote the screenplay for this, adapted off of Vandermeer's book, but Vandermeer was like, yo, it's nothing like my book in a lot of ways. It deviates. The core ideas are the same, but he really took it his own. But I love it. Like, Vandermeer's review of the film was great. It's not my book, but that doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, well,
you know, and I think that that's a great approach because, you know, I mean, that's, I think, the way, you know, people, writers should be like, yo, he made it his own. I'd rather him do that than try to make my vision and do it wrong.
Yeah, and then it also plays to what I mentioned before, where we're seeing someone who is already a fantastic writer really, really start nailing the visual aspects of filmmaking because it's a show me, don't tell me, and I think this film does that. Whereas maybe it's B movie predecessors were a little too much telling and not showing because of budget and technology. I love this movie. I think because it, on top we talked about the fun monsters, the cool themes. There's also a really great level of humanity, and not to mention the fact that it's working with an all female cast that doesn't feel pandering It doesn't feel like hey, you heard about this Me Too movement? Let's make a movie full of ladies. People will buy this shit. No, it feels like the film was crafted that way.
You're right. What it's so like the women are all pretty damn fleshed out characters. They're not just, you know, like even you know, every one of them has like interesting backstory, is interesting stuff. You know, some more than others, obviously, but they're all like there. You know, I mean, you know, when you find out the motivation of why the psychiatrist is leading this exposition, that's a pretty interesting story. You know, you know, and Lena's whole motivation is obviously, we know from the door, we know that motivation, but it's very interesting when you hear the other girls, gals, women. Sorry, I'm being pandering. The other three women in the group, when you hear them, you know, share their stories, I think it's fantastic.
Oh yeah.
You know, like they might not get quite as deep as the others, but you kind of get where they're coming from, why they're doing it. And what's interesting too is what you see a video, that demonstrates. First of all, it's really creepy body horror. The video. Secondly, it demonstrates the madness that's going on amongst the men who were there before, and that same madness is then later displayed by the women. So it's not like it's saying women are, you know, they're treating them all as equals in a lot of ways. Like they're all being affected by this weird mutant thing. You know, and it's not like, oh, well, women are different and it hits them differently and they're worse or better. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, I feel like it's a very, the gender politics of this movie are very much that it's all about, it's not about, you know, making people have to serve a certain gender role or anything. And I think that's good. I think that really serves this film really well.
Oh, yeah, there's not a whole lot of women be shopping kind of jokes.
No, not at all.
Although I wish Sinbad was in it.
Women be blowing away crocodiles with machine guns.
Right. And, before we kind of wrap it up, I did want to mention what is so great about this film is, and to me, what kind of was the moment where I go, okay, this film is my favorite so far this year is, when they're having that interaction, when they finally get to, they get to this compound, you know, where they're nearing where the site is that they're investigating. They watch this horrific video. They go through these things, and then there's a conversation where Natalie Portman asks the psychologist, you know, like, you know, why did her husband sign up for a suicide mission? And I love that explanation when she's describing that nobody is trying to commit suicide. You self-destruct, you're not killing yourself. You're self-destructing, where you destroy relationships. You smoke, you drink, you destroy your body. That these are just physiological things that we can't stop. And I love how that starts hinting at why this film isn't called Assimilation, that it's called Annihilation. That we're getting to, and I think it's such good writing, but I do have a complaint. I want to mention in a second.
Oh, okay, let's hear it.
Stop casting Natalie Portman in these kinds of roles. I think she's a fine actress, but she has such little charisma that I I think it can become distracting because there's certain parts of the film where I really think you could have shuffled any of the other actresses in this film to do her role and do it better.
Interesting because I actually think that her, what you're calling lack of charisma, and I don't know if I would use those words, but I get what you're saying. I actually think that serves this role really well.
But see, I think you can still play this subdued cerebral character with what I would describe as more character. I think Natalie Portman, I think she's been, you know, when she's used right, she's really great. I love her. You know, I love her in Black Swan. I loved her in Closer and films like that. But I don't know. I don't think she can carry a film with this much weight the way that she acts. Because it's I don't think she's a bad actress. I just think the way she acts is, I don't know. It doesn't, let's just
it's
say.
It's interesting because I don't know for sure when I say this, but I honestly think I might have liked this film less if it was a more charismatic actress who carries herself with quote unquote more character, because I think a large part of why I like this film is because of the manner. I mean, I don't know. I think she's pretty perfect for the role, but I completely get where you're coming from too. I just don't know that I agree. I'm not sure what I think because
yeah, I mean, I guess
it's hard to know unless I'd seen it with someone else, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And also, man, in terms of Natalie Portman, who I've been underwhelmed with my entire movie-going experience, dude, and Jackie, I'll give her credit. She deserved the Oscar for that.
I've never seen Jackie, although I just watched a movie with her last night that I'll mention in my recommendations when we wrap up. Even though it's a completely different type of film, just the connection is just Natalie Portman. So, but yeah. So Annihilation and Ex Machina, both phenomenal films. Not by no means are they necessarily perfect films, but to be fair, to me, a perfect film is typically relatively imperfect. I don't like a movie that's like by the book perfect all the time, because when it is, sometimes it's just boring. You know, there are some decisions and choices made by Garland that maybe I would have made differently, but who the hell cares? The guy's clearly got something going for him, and I'm really excited to see what happens next.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I don't see him slowing down at all. I think he's going to be.
I hope he sticks with the horror sci-fi genre because I think he does it really well. I think it's in his DNA, so I don't think he's going to veer too far. But you know, I want to see. You know, I would love to see a straight out really dark horror film. Then to be fair though, when I think about it, Ex Machina is really dark. you know, yeah. It really.
Did you
is.
Know? I mean, I'm about to say we watched nearly 4 hours of darkness.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, these are both, they both end. I mean, the endings are what make these movies horror. There's also a lot of other stuff in them that are very horrific. So, I mean, I definitely, maybe, what I mean is, maybe if he veered into a real world horror a bit and a little bit less sci-fi, it would be interesting. But overall, like Ex Machina is sci-fi, but feels like it could be real. So that's really fucked. Yeah. You know, because of the world we live in today. So you know, ultimately, what I'm really saying is I just want to keep seeing him do his shit.
Yeah, and he, I mean, you look back and it's hard to remember. He's been doing this kind of dark shit for 20 years now. I don't see him, you know, turning around and doing a romantic comedy, you know, anytime soon.
No. I mean, even his writing, it's always been, The Beach is very... It's dark. It's interesting fantasy sci-fi concepts. I wouldn't say it's really very horror, but at the same time, it is it's really dark in its concepts. It's also, I think every one of his films has a lot of social commentary in it. You know, I mean, and films and writing. You know, The Beach is very satirical in a lot of spots. These two movies are both very very much. Films about society and about how we as people handle things the right and wrong way, decisions we make that are bad, you know, like I said, the playing God thing. There's a lot of stuff going on here. And, you know, each one of them could warrant their own you know, 4-hour discussion if we wanted to go that route. But they're just very, very interesting films, and ultimately, I just think they're good, and they're just really well done. And the only reason Ex Machina wasn't in my top 10 the year it came out is I didn't see it till the following February. So, you know, once I saw it, I was like, shit, this would have been like number one last year. So, you know, and Annihilation is, you know, if it doesn't finish first, it's going to finish top 3 or 4 at the end of the year for me. I mean, I'd be really surprised if it's not number one. But, you know, I'm definitely a huge fan.
When films like this are released this early in the year, kind of like Get Out was last year and The Witch the year before, I hate how early it's released because you end up, you know, kind of forgetting about it towards the end of the year. And I think this film was good enough where I think it probably should have gotten more like a September, October release, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, and I mean, I am a little baffled by Netflix not going theatrical worldwide, but I'm happy they went theatrical here because the film is clearly made for a theater. I was really happy I got to see it in a theater. So, you know, the sound and the visuals, you know, I watched it on my 4K TV. It looked great, you know. But it wasn't the same, you know, still. It was definitely a theatrical movie.
Oh, absolutely. And that was a nice little humble brag there, by the way, with your 4K TV.
Oh, why don't you have a fucking 4K TV? It's 2018, motherfucker.
I got a 3D TV, but I don't have a 4K TV.
You have a 3D TV. What is this, 2015?
Dude, I bet on the wrong technology.
You definitely did, man, because that shit ain't lasting. You know, in fact, I feel like the only people who are still putting out 3D DVD movies, 3D Blu-ray movies. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh,
is anybody
no.
else still putting them out? I think it's just Disney.
Yeah, and actually, I think they've stopped making 3D televisions, like, altogether.
Oh, man. I know that Disney still releases movies in 3D, at least as recently as, like, one or two of their last ones. But yeah. I don't think anyone else really is. I think it's really Disney.
I literally just wanted to watch Pacific Rim in 3D at my house, and I do so 3 or 4 times a year.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
All right, well, let's wrap up.
Let's wrap up with some recommendations. And so, since I already teased mine, I'll go first. Completely unrelated to Alex Garland, but the connection is Natalie Portman, and the reason I'm recommending it is because I watched it last night. Mostly because it's on Hulu right now, and it is being removed from Hulu at the end of the month, so I wanted to make sure I watched it because I've been wanting to see it for a few years, and it's a movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt called Hesher. I don't know what I just watched last night, but I kind of loved it. It is a really weird movie. Have you seen Hesher?
I love Hesher. I love what's his name? Dwight from The Office in that movie. Who gives?
Oh, my God.
Such an amazing performance.
Honestly, everybody is really good in that movie. So the movie is basically about this, like, drifter. I feel like the movie takes place, it's not specific to a different time. It could be today, but it feels more like the 80s to me, mostly because of the way this drifter is, kind of the metalhead mentality he has, the way he's dressed, as well as the house that they're in has, you know, big boxy TVs and whatever. It could just be that they live in grandma's house and she still has stuff from the 80s in the house, which is quite possible as well. But the way everybody's dressed, it feels kind of like 80s, early 90s. It doesn't really matter what time it is, though, because that's not about what the movie's about. It's about this drifter who floats into the life of this family who is going through horrible trauma. This is from the beginning. This little boy lost his mother, and so he's going through it, and the family's really going through it. Dad is going through it as much as anybody, maybe worse. And this guy walks into their life, and he is basically does whatever he wants, whenever he wants, and it changes the family. It's really, really, really interesting. And Natalie Portman plays a really interesting character in that film as well. So, yeah, I definitely recommend it. It's on Hulu, at least I want to say it's leaving like mid-June, so check it out before it disappears.
Oh yeah, no, that's a movie I kind of forgot about. I'm glad you mentioned it because that's a good another just kind of serious human drama with some interesting elements in there. And God, man, I always go back to how much I love Rainn Wilson when he plays those kind of roles in Also, you know, the movie we talked about in our first episode 1 year ago, Super, which is one of my favorite films still. But I went the opposite route on this whole ordeal and actually picked a sci-fi film with similar themes, unlike my host here who decided to do a domestic drama. Just saying.
Hey, you know, I had Natalie Portman on the brain, buddy.
Oh, yeah, man. I picked 1986's film From Beyond, directed by the great Stuart Gordon, a film that I think we'll eventually find a way to kind of put into the show. It's a film responsible for a lot of our generation's boners with Barbara Crampton in that S&M outfit. Really, what I kind of tied in with it was this idea, because in this film, a scientist is basically unlocking the pineal gland with this device called the resonator, and what it ends up doing is creating these grotesque monsters that are kind of amalgamations of like their id and their desires and their personality and their surroundings, and create this like very mad scientist but ultra sexual film that I know a lot of B movie fans of course love this. It's part, you know, came out, you know, not too long after the great Reanimator and a lot of other Stuart Gordon films. But I don't know, I think it's similarly themed but in a much sleazier, goopier way, and I'm sure there's a crossover in, you know, people that are fans of it. And also the fact that this movie has got such a good performance by Ken Foree. He's another one of those guys that kind of got swept up in, you know, the convention circuit and only shows up in movies to act like Ken Foree now. But, you know, really gives a great performance. And I wish we would have gotten to see him act more, you know, than we did. But, like him and Tony Todd and all those guys, man, just kind of got sucked into that convention life where, you know...
Listen, you're busy complaining about Ken Foree not acting enough, and he was in many episodes of Keenan and Kel, okay?
Well, Dave, I'm not knocking Keenan and Kel. I love those guys. But Ken Foree...
That's also over a decade old. I don't know what he's done more recently. Oh, yeah! Dude, action in Lords of Salem.
Oh, yeah, no, the problem I have with that is it feels like he's showing up to be Ken Foree.
Yeah, that's true.
I like that he played this different role that wasn't just Dawn of the Dead in From Beyond. But you know, he's an incredibly talented actor. I love the guy. But yeah, that's my kind of, you know, weigh in on suggestions this month. Everybody, thank you so much for listening for this past year. We really appreciate it. We have a lot of fun doing this. But, you know, we don't want to be just screaming in the void. So don't forget, in order to win your copy of Annihilation, which the studios so sweetly donated to us, make sure you share your favorite episode. Also, you can tweet at me some of the dumbest shit that I've ever said that's recorded forever and lives on the internet past my death. But thank you guys so much. Thank you to Vinegar Syndrome for sponsoring us for the past year. Also, don't forget, Buried Alive Film Festival's coming up. Yeah, man. We got Justin out there handling PR, knocking it out of the park. We got a lot of great shit coming to you this year. If you're a filmmaker, go on Film Freeway. Let us see what you're working with, and we will make sure to play it. So, hey, you got anything else, Justin?
Shake that ass. Show me what you're working with.
Danger! All right. Thank you, folks, so much. No,
coming in. Thanks again for a year. Anyone who's been listening, whether it's one episode, every episode, just keep on listening. We appreciate it. And if you have suggestions or ideas of things you want us to cover and stuff, yo, we welcome that. And we're going to have our Patreon going in the next couple weeks. We're really excited to make that announcement. So hopefully by the next episode or soon thereafter, you'll be hearing about that. And we have some cool shit that's going to be coming down with that. So thanks a lot, guys. Maybe we don't say this enough. We definitely need some rate and reviews over at iTunes as well as wherever the hell you listen to this. Google Play, Stitcher, Radio Public. I have it on a whole bunch of sites. So check it out. Whatever way you listen, we appreciate it. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Have a good day and peace.